Today on the Wrinkled Engineer podcast, Justin, Kara, and Dylan join me. We're going to discuss a theoretical house and the optimal air conditioning system that we could use. We're going to talk about how we got into engineering. We're going to look at some Mandalorian costuming and some of the techniques that Dylan uses to make them look awesome. Finally, Justin's going to share some words of wisdom after having just finished a season of coaching Pee Wee flag football. Welcome to the Wrinkled Engineer podcast. I'm Gates. I'm here to my left with Justin and to my right with Kara. They are both mechanical slash plumbing engineers. So not structural this week. We're not going to be talking about structural engineering too much, so that may be sad for some of you. But I've been thinking about the house that I want to build for a while, well, since I was little. And part of the problem I have is considering the air conditioning and the cooling of that house, because I have several different competing requirements. One, I like to be comfortable. To me, that's the most important thing. Two, I've got a computer room that has like 30 hard drives that spin 24/7. So the idea of keeping that room nice and cold without having to cool everything else down to that level would be nice. And then I also have my shop, which needs to stay, low humidity, but doesn't need to be cold most of the time, only when I'm working in it. So Justin, I sent you a text with a sketch of like an 1,800, 2,000 square foot habitable house. Right. With a shop.
As opposed to an uninhabitable house.
Yeah, well, yes. With a shop attached to the garage that's like 600 square feet.
Okay, and you're air conditioning the garage.
Yeah, air conditioning the garage, though, just to like that 80 degrees to make it comfortable. Yeah. It's not 100 degrees in your car.
I feel like you should have dreamed bigger, but go on.
I'm trying to be reasonable, and I've been thinking about this house for a while, and then like a 50 to 100 square foot tech room that's got the server and everything in it. And so my structural engineering brain about a decade ago figured the way to do this was obviously thermostats in every room. So you know the temperature, so at night you can drop the temperature in the bedrooms and raise the temperature out in the living spaces, and during the day reverse it. The other challenge I have is that my house is almost never empty. Mm-hmm. We always have people in the house almost every hour of the day. So I was looking at louvered options, mm-hmm. where when the thermostat kicks on, it opens the louver to your room and allows more air in. I was thinking very physically about how to solve this problem.
A very structural engineer solution.
It doesn't exist.
But.
And I would love for it to. Well, I was going to be homebrew. I figured I could make this work with just thermostats and the call wires, and it would work. But ultimately, yeah. I'd want more control than that.
So where you start off wrong is if you get like a standard like house piece of equipment, and you have it all does is throw air out, right? So if you put a damper on these different dampers and your thermostat and it starts closing, it slows the air down. You put more air across the coil, and I don't know if you've ever frozen a coil before.
I've seen it.
Seen it, right?
In commercial units.
That would happen because you get the air moving. You got a lot of air. You got air moving slower.
So it's getting colder. It's
getting colder. The humidity's sitting there, and then it gets colder and it starts cycling it down. So not the best idea, especially then. Because the thermostat, the unit would still operate off of like one thermostat. Mm-hmm. All these other ones would just control dampers. So that's not really a solution.
I think it would have been cobbled together and not worked very well. And I guess the initial premise, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the most efficient air conditioner would be an air conditioner that ran 24 hours a day and the heat lost matched the heat pump output. Right. So it just kept everything in perfect equilibrium.
That's what the theory of like a VRF system, like for big buildings, and you're a moderate client, half the building today, the sun's on, they're hot, they start to need cooling, but the other side of the building hasn't seen the sun, and it's a big enough building so that they don't need it, so that all the refrigerant goes back to the VRF system, and they have their own internal heat exchangers. So in theory, that's where the VRF comes in.
Okay.
But they don't really make them small. That's what I'm saying. You should dream bigger, right? Because the bigger you get, the easier it is to do it.
Well, it's getting there, right? Because 10 years ago when I was thinking about this, it seemed like those systems were non-existent except for industrial scale, like huge commercial buildings. And mm-hmm. now those packages are getting mm-hmm. smaller and smaller for, smaller office buildings and things like that. So taking that premise that a small unit that can round-robin rooms is more efficient than a large unit that handles all the rooms at once and then turns off for a period of time and turns back on, what does the setup look like? What does the hardware look like to create a system that I'm describing that gives me point control in each room, but is efficient and works well?
So the most elaborate one would be what they call VRF, which is the variable refrigerant flow, which is you got a big central condensing unit. Now, I don't think they get down to like the house you're describing is like a 4-ton house, maybe 4.5 to 5, depending on how much stuff you put in there, because you put a lot of crap in your house. But
a lot of heat load. I'm full of hot air. I'm full of hot air is the problem.
Yes, there's that. There's one, you talk a lot. And then two, there's the server. Not many houses have a home server running 24/7. So you have to count that. So you might be on the 5-ton range. And really, if I remember correctly, because I generally don't design systems that small, but 7.5 tons is really where the VRF starts to kick in. You get this big central condensing unit. All the units go back to it. Now, the issue you have is every single manufacturer does it differently. Samsung has some smaller stuff where they have different ports, and you just run your copper right to the condensing unit, and you have multiple ports for multiple units, and everything happens there.
So there's a manifold at the unit?
Yeah. But I think that's smaller. Then you have something like a Mitsubishi, where they actually have the two lines that comes in, hits the heat exchanger.
And it just circulates the entire house?
Yeah, well, it hits the heat exchanger, and all your pipes come off of that. So that's where you get the, this room's heating, this room's cooling, and it's,
So you get some efficiency gain.
You get some efficiency there.
Moving around the energy from one room to another, basically.
Potentially, if it's running. I mean, if it's warm enough and it's still running, you could. I mean, but the bigger thing you would gain there is with that kind of system, and some of the other systems they have, is that you get the individual units, right? Instead of having that big condenser, big unit in the house, you have big unit outside, multiple small units. So when one room's set at 80, like I think you said you want to have your shop, that's not running.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some savings there. And then if it's just your wife home and your kids, and their kids in the bedroom and your wife's out in the living room, those units would run. And then the other rooms don't need to run because nobody's there, there's nothing going on.
Got it.
At set point. So that's where it would be. I mean, I think the problem you ultimately always will run into is price, right? That's a pretty elaborate system for a home, but it's what I would, if I'm building my perfect house, it's bigger than what you dream, but it's also
your mansion, your estate.
The grand estate that you make off an engineer's salary. And
I will mention Justin's a design manager, so we have different expectations of reality.
I'm supposed to be more grandiose.
So basically you're looking at one large unit or several smaller units. Can you split those into multiple rooms? Or
You'd have one.
Would it be zoned? That would be the zone.
The zoning is in the refrigerant line. So you'd have one condensing unit. If it on a smaller scale, you can do 4 units, I think, off of one small unit, like the suitcase style unit. And then you could have maybe multiple ones of those, or the ideal would be the big unit. So you have one unit, one condensing unit still at the end of the day, or maybe two if you need two systems, and then you have your air handlers on the side.
So it's ductless, right? So we're not running central air from a heat exchanger in your garage that connects to the cooling unit. Your heat exchanger's in each room. So what does that look like? What are the options? Is it a huge thing hanging off my wall? Is it buried in a ceiling now that's got to be extra deep?
There's different options. Like, the typical one you'll see is the thing hanging on the wall, right?
I don't like the way that looks. So
okay. And then they have the other ones where it's kind of a two-way throw. It kind of looks like a diffuser, like your square diffuser. You stick that in there, and like the unit sits above the ceiling. And then the other options are ones that you can put like up there, but they're a one-way blow, and they just go across that room. So that'd be more equivalent to like a diffuser you'd see in the ceiling of your house. So that would be likely what you go with. They're starting to make ones where they have one that they always sell, and I've never seen anybody use it. It's a picture frame, and you can put your own picture in it.
Oh, that's
but it's actually a conditioning unit. So if you
what picture would you put in a picture frame, Kara? That's a duct or an air conditioner. I mean, it should at least be an LCD so that you could
flip through it.
Load up a bunch of pictures on it.
Maybe you can do that. I don't know.
I'm sure it's out there.
I'll be honest, that's not the I never thought about that.
I'd want it to just be a like a blue to red color to tell me what the temperature of the room is. And when it's on, it turns blue. And when it's off, it's red.
It's a very specific one.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay, so barring cost, but it's, I think the market's going this way, right? As
I think ultimately
the energy code kicks in and trickles down into the residential market.
Yeah, I think it's going that way. Eventually it'll get there. I mean, it's one of those things where right now it's simpler to do it. I mean, the other thing you're going to find is a lot of the labor to install it. Those things can get messed up, but they're not that hard, but people just aren't familiar. So,
no, okay. Well, I do it all myself, so as you well know,
yes.
I don't like to pay people to build things for me. It feels wrong for some reason. All right, cool. So it's doable.
It's doable. You start budgeting now.
So it's a big chunk of the building cost. But ultimately, you should be saving quite a bit of energy because you're cooling your needs, not cooling everything.
Right. And it depends on how you use your house and everything. I mean, Florida foam bill down here, I think we talked, ours are about the same. It's like $300 in the peak of
summer.
When people are home during the day and they don't want to go outside and...
getting that humidity out of the house.
Getting the humidity out so that everybody leaves the door open. I don't know. It might be just me and my problem. But
anybody with kids has that problem.
Yes. So I think that'll start spiking it and run it. So, you get $300 a month. I think you got to look at the fact that, maybe you save $100 in the peak months. And then you save a little more in the winter. Because you're not going to have to run much, especially down here. So
what happens as you hit a peak capacity? So it's a hot day, and let's say rather than having a 7-ton unit, it was more reasonable. It was like a 4-ton unit for a 2,000 square foot house, and 75% of the house needs cooling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the system just degrades slowly, right? It's just not cooling as fast, or is it because it's pulling more heat with the
regular system or
with the
VRF,
or is it spinning up and actually cooling down to a lower point?
It's sized too. Like when you typically, I mean, if you have a bigger unit, you size it like 125% of the indoor load to the outdoor load.
Okay.
For a smaller one like a house, you probably wouldn't do that. You'd probably go 1-to-1 because there is going to be time in the summer where
everything needs
cooling no matter what. So yeah, it would just crank up and it run. I mean, they have. Inside there, instead of like having that on-off compressor, you hear like kick on.
Mm-hmm.
It would
just be the fan, right? But
the fan kicks on, but it's got a compressor. They got a compressor on it, but it's a scroll compressor, and it can ramp a little bit.
So okay,
on the more elaborate ones, not necessarily the ones you get.
See, I would want like a priority list my kids' rooms go offline if my room's getting too hot. Like, I think there should be a priority list. Okay. And the person paying the bill should get priority on the cooling.
I just don't give them a thermostat.
Oh, there you go. Control
air.
Turn it off on them. Yeah. That would, they would enjoy their fans, I'm sure, instead. All right. Well, cool. Thank you for that information. I hope everybody learned something, because being a structural engineer, I know these two do things with mechanical systems, but I don't really care about it until I have to support it on a roof. So it's good to know. So I wanted to talk about how you got into engineering and how you chose this particular path. And I know my story is very different than Justin's story, but mine's atypical. I think you'd agree.
Yeah.
What's youngest to oldest?
Sure.
All right, Kara.
All right.
How did you decide on MEP, mechanical plumbing, fire?
So the MEP was more chosen for me. I got into engineering.
Really? You didn't have a choice on this, okay.
Well, so I got into engineering. I was always really good in math and physics and the sciences. I am incredibly squeamish and would have died in any sort of anatomy class, so that was out of the question. And I don't really enjoy teaching other people. My explanation methods are pretty atypical and very unique. As Justin can attest.
So this was just the last option, was going to engineering?
I really wanted to do, like, physics, theoretical physics, but
I... Than communications. That's the real default. Sorry.
But I didn't want to teach the rest of my life and just work on one thing. So I started off in mechanical engineering, kind of with my eye toward the sky. Like, I wanted to actually work NASA... airplanes. I have a fascination with airplanes, rockets, all that stuff. And so I generalized in mechanical engineering got a couple internships doing drafting over the summer. I was kind of that CAD person that they always say, oh, just give it to the intern. I was that person. And then one day I landed an internship with an MEP company, and here I am. The rest is history.
Do you like it?
I do.
What's your favorite part of the MEP to work with?
Fire protection slowly getting up there.
Sorry.
It's a very unique beast. And now that I'm starting to learn the codes and understand the codes a lot better, now I'm starting to enjoy kind of doing that design work.
I guess my issue is not with fire protection engineers. They're some of the best engineers I know. It's the fire code that makes me cringe a little bit, and I have some reserved thoughts about it.
It makes me cringe, too.
I will not share it this time.
I've winced, I've cringed, I've cried, you know, all that.
Yes. Well, you work with Justin. I think you're younger than me, right? So,
am I? Yeah, I am.
Yeah, barely. So, yeah. Mentally, you're a lot younger than I am.
Yes, emotionally, yeah, very young.
So how did you come about mechanical engineering, specifically mechanical engineering and building systems?
So that was, in high school, you know, when you're trying to pick a major, they're like, here's this book. And have you seen those books?
Mm-hmm. Through them? You took a little test, filled out some questions.
Well, yeah, and obviously I did good in math. I did good in pretty much everything. I wasn't a very enthusiastic student.
Are you enthusiastic about anything?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes.
Just
depends.
Just think, it's a rare shade of your character.
Life grinds you down. But, so I had two classes in high school that I actually really enjoyed: architectural drafting and engineering drafting. So I found a major flipping through the book that said architectural engineering. I was like, that's pretty cool. Let's try that. What's that about? So I did a little more look into it, and there's only 16 schools. So one, that helped kind of narrow things down. Then it turns out I wanted to, and then I applied to Penn State and Drexel. Penn State's the original. I didn't plan this. Penn State plays Ohio State. I do like that. I'm a big proponent of their program. But they started the architectural engineering program, and they taught everybody else, and they all struggled to keep up. And I say that for the internet and everybody.
Okay.
Out there. But Penn State, you know, the architectural engineering program. So I went up there. I met with the guy, and I, you know, when you start, you're just a general architectural engineer, and then you have to pick a discipline after your
study. Seems like a juxtaposition of architectural engineer.
Our architectural classes, maybe, I don't know if it's the right time, but the architectural classes were not what the architects did, and they hated us for it. So you go there, you have to pick three options: construction management, electrical, mechanical, or structural. So I wasn't sure. I actually tried to change major second year. Thought about dropping out second year. Decided to stay, and then mechanical was the one I liked the best. Lighting, electrical, I didn't like the lighting. I don't like structural. It's boring. It's very boring. Concrete.
It's just a little advanced for you.
No, it's boring. Exists. Two things going together. Are they going to fall? Probably not, because you oversized it.
That's right.
So I picked mechanical, and then I actually grew into enjoying it and got internships and all that crap. And here I'm at.
Here you are.
Thriving in my career, of course, as some would say, or whatever.
Awesome. All right, so I guess that leaves me. The structural engineer, the oddball, I guess, of this panel. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a commercial electrician when I was a kid.
Swinging a miss.
I thought that would just be really fun. Like, it seemed like a cool career. You'd work on big equipment.
It does. I mean, yeah, it's probably more fulfilling.
Yeah, and I watched a lot of, like, Home Time and Norm Abram's wood shop and stuff as a kid. So I saw these, like, things mm-hmm. getting built. I didn't watch Bob Vila.
Well, was that like a specific thing?
Bob Vila?
Yeah. What, I mean, like, no, like, why didn't you watch him?
I just didn't like the guy.
So, like, that's an odd.
I had a Tim Taylor from Home Improvement image of Bob Vila as a kid. He was just a host. He didn't really ever do anything, like, you know, but Norm Abram built stuff. So that's what got me interested in construction. And I felt like a commercial electrician was probably something that would be very hard on my body when I got older. Well, I got to this age. And it would be difficult to continue doing that kind of work. And that work is fun. I don't think I'd want to get into like superintendent level type stuff. I like doing the work. So when I was about 10 years old, the alternate to electrical or being an electrician was designing buildings. But I knew I didn't want to be an architect. I wanted to deal with the physics and the math and the structural side of things. So I was 10 years old and I figured out I want to be a structural engineer. Which I think is that's a little unusual.
Odd.
It's odd, but I'm an odd person.
I still wasn't sure up until about 25, 26.
And so, you know, I had a few dream jobs that I about when I was 12, I started to figure out where I really wanted to focus my structural engineering work on. And I've been working ever since about that day to do what I do now. So I do feel like I fulfilled my goal in life working as a structural engineer. It's a challenging road, though. Yes, as Justin pointed out, it's really simply keeping things from falling down. The intriguing thing about structural engineering is that when you mess up, people can die, and lots of people can die. Mechanical engineering, you mess up, and we just don't have heat and air conditioning. And
someone gets Legionella.
Yeah, there are some diseases when you don't design.
You can kill people if you really want to.
Yeah,
if you set your mind to it, you can do anything.
But it's a little more difficult to, you know.
Yeah. I'm not going to drop steel on their head.
Right. So that's what intrigues me is that inherent understanding of risk and hazards. And
so are you when you're calculating things, you're like, instead of having any safety factor, like, no safety factor. Let's
do what the code tells me to do. But it's understanding that no system's perfect and that it's all statistics.
Mm-hmm.
That even if it's designed for the code, there's still, after 3 or 4 deviations, a probability that something could go wrong. It helps me live my life the way that, you know, in that same manner, that things can go wrong whether you plan for the best or not. So
you realize how different yours is compared to, like, Kara didn't like blood, and she didn't like kids. She became an engineer. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and you're like, at 12, I knew I was going to be a structural engineer.
Well, so let me ask you this.
Very unusual.
Am I not a focused person with respect to my discipline? To a fault.
Yeah. You're a structural engineer. Like, that's like, yeah, that's what I think about.
As Tim and I talked on the first podcast, the key characteristic of a structural engineer is our arrogance. That's the most important attribute.
I said that recently. Somebody,
so
without any context, somebody said something was holding something against the structural engineer and said he was condescending. And I said, they all are. Every single one.
There are a few exceptions.
I would never hold that against a structural engineer. Most engineers are.
Yes, and structural engineers just really, they take it to a whole other level.
That you get your black belt in the condescending.
Yeah, so that's my story. I spent way too much time in college to get through my program, but, you know, if I had to do it again, I'd hopefully make it through quicker, but it is what it is on that. All right, now we're going to talk about something that's really cool, really fun, a little bit, not something adults would normally do. Sorry. Not something I would normally do. I don't understand the obsession, but tons of people are into this, so I get it, that it's cool.
And pretty relevant right now, too.
It is very relevant, because today, Mandalorian came out this week. So Kara and her husband Dylan, so Dylan's going to come join us, both like to do the whole costuming thing.
Yeah.
Not just wear them, but make them.
Oh, yeah. Make them, wear them, play dress up.
Yeah. See, I don't understand it, but I get it. I get that this is a thing. So what do you got for us today?
Well, me and her are actually part of a international costuming group called the Mandalorian Mercs Costuming Club. It's a fully licensed not-for-profit, and we costume for charity.
So, specifically Mandalorian?
Specifically Mandalorian costumes, yeah.
And for those who live in a bubble.
Mandalorians is a race of people from the Star Wars universe who get to wear cool T-shaped helmets.
And which characters would we know?
Boba Fett, Jango Fett are arguably the two main Mandalorians.
But now there's a third.
Din Djarin from the new popular Disney series, The Mandalorian.
Cool. So what do you got? What are we really talking about here?
So, We have, this is the helmet that I've made. Very nice. Just a typical Boba Fett style helmet, T-visor.
And this is Kara's?
Yes. This is actually Kara's, yes.
We should have made you wear it for the podcast.
Yeah, and then this is using a method known as a slush casting. It's an equal parts A and B liquid resin that we then combine together, mix, and then dump in a mold.
Okay, so it's an epoxy type of mixture.
And then here we have the mold right here. I'll use the cups, and I'll dump the cups in here, resin, slosh it around, cut all the helmet, and then after a few minutes, 10, 20 minutes, I can demold it, and then I get what's known as that.
Cool. So how do you get that?
This is, let me known as the...
Because that seems like the genesis here is...
Yeah, so it's made of two parts. You have the inner silicone layer known as the mother mold, and then you have the outer rigid layer, which is the shell, which keeps everything rigid.
Oh, that's just fiberglass?
This is fiberglass, yeah. There's a few different methods. You can use other companies make hard, rigid layerings that you could put on. But and then you dump your resin in there, shake it around, and then it's all bolted together around the helmet. You just remove that, and then you basically just peel the silicone off the helmet up onto itself. And then you get nice helmet that you can then paint and spend another.
So what does it look like when it comes out of the mold? Is it smooth? Is it
The outside is smooth, and if you do a good job, so is the inside. Sometimes depending if you don't move it enough or you wait too long when you're mixing the resin up and it starts to cure, so then you'll get like lumps on the inside and it'll be lopsided and it won't be nice and smooth.
Very cool. Yeah. So what's the And then the finish is paint, but I mean, a lot of sanding or priming, or is it?
A lot of, you get
hit with some like rattle can, airbrush.
You can use either or. A lot of people will use rattle can, airbrush, get you that. It's like extra mile, Mm-hmm. This helmet, after that's been cast, it only needs very light sanding for like paint to adhere, or, whether it be airbrush or a rattle can.
So one of the things I know Dylan does really well is the aging of the props, making it look
weathering,
making it look like it's old and it's been used.
Oh yes.
So bring that Kara's helmet back out. I guess show us some of your weathering on this that makes it look like she was actually fighting.
It's a very tedious process because you first sand the whole helmet, and then you're going to prime the helmet with a neutral color, like gray or white primer. And then what you'll do is you paint the whole helmet silver, or whatever you want to reveal, silver. And then you'll use a type of masking fluid. There's a latex masking fluid, or you can use toothpaste, or some people I've seen use condiments like mustard. Just you'll paint it on there, whatever you want the damage to look like, and then you'll take your main color, spray that main color on.
So you just need something that's going to come off easily.
Exactly, yeah. With the masking fluid itself, the paint doesn't cure on the masking fluid. It stays soft, so you basically just wipe it off, and then there you have your detail revealed. You have your primary color, and then you have that chip away to the damaged or the metal color underneath the helmet. So it gives it a layer. It gives it a more three-dimensional effect, makes it look lived in.
So you're rubbing dirt or anything like that, or dark spots? Or
black wash, or basically just a wash. It's acrylic paint and water. So you'll then...
So you can get stuck in the corners and stuff.
Exactly.
And
you just put it wherever you want, leave it on for a few seconds, take a paper towel, wipe it off. Can you do that with any black colors or earth tone colors just to get like grit and grime to make it look lived in and used.
Very cool. What's the visor made out of?
The visor is a Hobart face shield. It's actually a welding face shield that I cut down.
Oh, so you've got the nice tint to it, but you can still see.
Yep. It properly obscures the face so you can't see the wear inside, and then you can see really well out of it.
And partially obscures the wearer's vision inside.
Yes. I have no vision to my lower left and right, which is perfectly where kids like to sit.
Yep.
They come up to you and you stick right there, you try to walk and you bump into them.
So this is only a piece of Kara's costume, right? You've got a full kit.
Oh, yes.
So what are the reactions you get when you wear this, Kara? And what events have you gone to?
So our big event is MegaCon Orlando. That's usually where we're there for the whole weekend. We've done parades before. We've done Archaeologists for Autism up in Merritt Island, birthday parties, weddings, pretty much, you name it.
Yeah.
You name it, we've been there. So there's two reactions we get. People either are like, oh my goodness, Mandalorian, Star Wars, or we've been called Power Rangers. We've been asked if
that's
we were
the purple color.
Yeah. We've been asked if we were from Fortnite before.
That was the most hurtful one to me.
Yeah, that one was the most hurtful, yeah. But you know, it's people either know who we are or don't know who we are, and I think now with the Mandalorian, now a lot more people recognize that T visor.
Yeah, the iconic T visor is like Mandalorian. I'm like, yes, thank you.
At least Star Wars.
Yeah, I've gotten the Hulk before.
Yeah.
So my predominantly red and black kit. What we call the costume, a kit.
Interesting. That's very cool. So any other fun characters that you guys, other than Mandalorians, that you like to kit out for?
I have a Rey. I also mask around as Rey. Yeah. We made Sabine Wren from Star Wars Rebels for my little sister.
That was a nightmare of a paint job.
Yeah.
We used airbrush for that, and I have, if you know what Sabine Wren looks like from the Clone Wars, very, very intricate and was
very colorful.
Very colorful and above my level of expertise. Yeah. I had to learn quick.
Right now, we're also working on a Stormtrooper.
Yep.
We have all the pieces. Now we're just kind of fitting them to us and putting the whole costume together.
Trying as close as we can to make that movie accurate, even implementing the same techniques they used to put on the armor and attach the armor to the person in the original trilogy.
So I'm seeing you got hard edge fabrication. You've got the more organic shapes, but then with like a Rey costume, you got to get into sewing, and that seems like a whole different trade.
It is sewing and makeup.
I am not great at sewing. I'm trying to get her more into sewing. So
yeah, you started me off on sewing, and I've kind of taken it. I've made like flight suits. I made some parts of Rey, other parts I sourced out, which is fine, but I'm learning, slowly learning. Yeah. It's a fun process, and I'm also learning how to do makeup, because a lot of characters require, face characters require makeup. The nice thing about Mandalorians is you have a helmet on and don't need makeup.
Don't need to worry about what my face looks like for pictures.
Yeah. Even though we still smile behind...
Yeah, you smile behind
You
the
still
helmet,
smile
yeah.
behind the helmet.
Or make faces, stick your tongue out, you know, no one can see.
Very nice. We'll have to get some... We'll add some pictures that we'll get from you on here, but that's cool. Well, Dylan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll look forward to maybe some more tips on this stuff, because I love the fabrication process. I may not like to dress up, but the idea of making things that look authentic and the best place to copy that is from the movies.
Yep.
You know,
yeah.
And they have very authentic things. And what's nice is you have an image of what you start with, and so when you make it, you know whether you achieved your goal or not because it looks the same. So it's a good metric. So your work's awesome.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
With looking at that, so cool. So Justin just finished a season of Pee Wee Flag Football.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to get some life lessons from Justin about this. How old were the kids?
7 and 8.
7 and 8, and your son's on the team?
Yes.
Okay, so...
That'd be really weird. It'd be really weird if you're coaching just...
I can see, yeah.
Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe that's not right.
Unless you're a professional peewee coach.
It's flag football's different. You know, if you don't have a kid and you're coaching flag football, if you're coaching like tackle, like there's something to build to there, you're not going to build.
You mean real football as opposed to?
Yeah. The ones where.
So, how was your season?
It's awesome.
Wow, that's completely different. The conversations I've had with you over the last 2 months have been very different.
It was, it was my first time. I've coached baseball before, and I was the assistant coach, and it was 7 and 8 year olds. So it's like,
same thing, right?
No. 7 and 8. I remember coaching baseball. Now the other guy, I had a lot more enthusiasm than him, and then he was very enthusiastic guy. And so maybe that enthusiasm is, you know, infectious, and it kept the kids interested. I don't know that I have that anymore. I don't know if I'm an effective coach. You know, and they said we don't keep score.
You're a design manager. I hope you're an effective coach. Just of adults or those who look like adults.
Kara, am I great at talking to people that work for me?
No. I'm the wrong person to ask, though, let's be honest.
So
I think there are a few people who would say you're good to talk to.
I could talk, but I don't do well when I'm annoyed.
That's true.
Which happens a lot.
Yes.
I'm the most annoyed person in the world. Justin's the most grumpy person I think I've ever met. So we make a pretty interesting
And I'm theory. Here to even all that out.
Yeah, yes. So she brings balance to the force here.
She's testing the theory of if you can be a good engineer and be happy. And I don't believe that's the case. Now, so taking it back to flag football. They had my son played last season, and he had like 11 kids on a team, and that's it's hard for kids to get to play last and all this stuff. So they sent out an email and said, "Hey, anybody willing to coach? We if not, otherwise we're gonna have like 11 kids on each team." And I was like, "Well, I don't want that because I want my son to play more, and I'm assuming other kids want more time to play. So I'll volunteer."
Oh, the goodness of your heart.
It was good intention. It was
mostly selfish for your son.
I mean, I'm thinking of my son, but I'm assuming most parents want their sons to play football. Nobody wants to come and sit there, watch your kids sit on the bench. So I tried to stick to the, everybody plays an equal amount of time and they get to try different things. So I tried to keep that, and we don't keep score, we don't do this. I mean, everybody keeps score, but they don't keep score, and they don't keep threes. But we're going to have playoffs. And we're going to rank the teams. And
it's like college football.
Yeah. And I knew it was coming, and we got ranked last. And it hurt my feelings. Because I was like, I don't know. I thought I was doing the right thing. I mean, there's not too much to teach. You know, like shuffle your feet, stay in front of the kids, pull the flag, catch the ball, throw. It's basics. Basics. So I thought I was teaching them that, but it's not. I'm not communicating.
You weren't running up the scoreboard.
No. We were good on defense, though. Very good on defense. Offense struggled to move, struggled to score.
So, now when I've had to deal with youth sports, the parents have always been what drove me nuts. But you told me your parents were wonderful.
My parents, I didn't have any problems.
But the kids...
I don't know, like, taking it back to baseball, what I expected, everybody was, like, paying attention, focused. You know, some people would, like, slip, but you're like, hey, mm-hmm. get there. I would run plays, and I mean, there was bodies on the ground. Because kids are, like, wrestling, and then somebody goes to throw, like, get the ball back to the center, let's run another play, just practice, throw the ball to center, somebody plays defense on them, they crack their heads together, and I'm like, guys, you can't do that, we're going to do this, this is what we're going to do.
But your son listened to you, right?
No. There were several times where I told him, you can't not listen too. I mean, he was better, above average in listening, but I don't know. That's what I realized. I was like, I don't know what to do in that situation when, like, these kids are like, I don't know what to do, and I'm not going to, you can't yell, you can't hit them, obviously, that's not... We're past that decade.
Yeah.
Right?
A little bit. Past your own son, you could let him do it.
No, I don't do that. But so I don't know if there's any life lessons there. I just know that I'm not a great coach.
Well, that's a good life lesson.
Don't try.
Do you stay away from Pee Wee coaching now? Or is that...
I signed up my son for a spring league, so I said maybe be assistant coach.
You can bring the snacks. And take roll.
I would do it again. I just maybe.
Oh, I will tell you, it has been quite entertaining to come in on Monday morning and have Justin explain the horrors of the weekend football games, or during the week after practice, just the consternation that exists when trying to deal with children.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, you know. And then obviously, this is an engineering podcast, right? So they don't teach you that in engineering. And
I don't know if we have the capacity for it.
Yeah, it's not day to day. It's not a thought in my head. So I was like, I would do it again. I would probably do it again. But it's. I don't know how do you keep kids working. And then you want the funny thing is the guy next to me. He looks over at the other team that's practicing, and all their kids are, like, doing the drill exactly right.
And sounding off in order.
They're doing drills. He's got them going – he's got them shuffling their feet. He's got them, like, going up, downs, warm-ups, and front, back. Like, all the shuffling and like, almost like ladder drills. And they're all doing it in unison. And he just looks at me. He's like, that makes me sick that they're, like – they're doing everything. They're doing everything perfectly. So I was like, it's clearly –
It's you.
It's possible. It is possible for them to listen and do it. I failed. So I got to figure out that fail. We're working on it. You know, we're going to study the tape and see what we can do better for next year.
Sounds good. Sounds good. All right. Well, any last words? I think that's a good note to leave off on.
Don't coach.
Don't coach.
Don't coach unless you know you're good at it.
Wise words. The trouble is, you're qualified to coach if you're willing to do it.
That's why I don't volunteer. Kids need volunteers. Don't listen to me. I'm an idiot.
Again, I'm the Rankled Engineer, Gates, Justin, Kara. Thanks for joining us. Have a good one.